Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masterson. Today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Israel to speak with Avraham Berg, the former Speaker of the Knesset. He has an op-ed in Sunday's New York Times, Israel's Fading Democracy, and we will discuss the portent of a war with Iran that a Romney presidency might lead to, given Romney's recent belligerent pronouncements in Israel and his closeness to Israel's hawkish Prime Minister. Then we will speak with Michael Tomasky, a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast. He has the cover story in the current issue of Newsweek, Mitt Romney's Wimp Factor, A Mouse in the White House, and we will discuss whether a candidate who dodges reporters, fears his base, and hides his taxes is too insecure to be president. Then finally, we will discuss the possibility that Mitt Romney is hiding his past income taxes that he refuses to make public because he participated in an IRS 2009 tax amnesty that 35,000 wealthy Americans who had hidden their money abroad took advantage of. Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at the University of Southern California, who served as the chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, joins us to discuss his recent article at CNN, Why Won't Romney Release More Tax Returns? Joining us now is Avraham Berg, who's the son of Holocaust survivors and has been active in politics as a leader in the Israeli Labor Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003 and is the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. He's now the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy, and has an article, an op-ed in Sunday's New York Times, Israel's Fading Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Avraham Berg.
Thank you for having me.
And you in Israel, of course, Avraham, just witnessed the arrival of recent arrival of the American presidential candidate Mitt Romney, who made very hawkish statements about supporting his friend, old friend Netanyahu, in a possible attack on Iran. It seems fairly blithe on the part of a foreign politician to suggest that Israel should go to war, and Israeli citizens, of course, would be the recipients of a counterattack from Hezbollah, Iran's proxy, raining down thousands and thousands of missiles upon Israelis. I found that quite, I found it extremely troubling, shall we say.
Romney's visit to Israel had three segments, and each and every one of them is a very embarrassing one. The first one is so many people around here and so many people around the world are asking themselves, is that really a serious presidential candidate? Is that the one? This is what he did in Great Britain, what he did in Poland, and came here and insulted the Palestinians and actually became a local warmonger, which is okay for him to stand behind Israel. Does he know what does that mean, that if Israel will strike Iran, will he send American soldiers to redeem us? Will he come to the Middle East to have another front with the Muslim world in order to clear the mess of what is behind him? What kind of a presidential policy he's going to have? That's an embarrassing one. The second embarrassing element is the kind of brutal, crude involvement of the Israeli prime minister in the presidential elections in the United States of America, almost taking an official line with one of the candidates, and by this actually creating a new strategy that Israel, that was for so many years be over and above political division in America, is becoming a partisan issue. And this is an awful development. And the last element is the open public debate in Israel. Should we or should we not attack Iran? I think it's a lunacy. It will not solve the Iranian nuclear race, and it will not solve the problem of Israel in the Middle East. On the contrary, when you put all the three of them together, you ask yourself, do we really want both the region and the West to elect this kind of leaders to lead us in the coming very difficult future?
Well, Avraham Berg, it would seem at this moment, given what's happening in Syria, with the likelihood of the Assad's falling, and that would be a strategic setback for Iran and for Hezbollah. Isn't this a time for Israel to basically to take a very quiet position and let the chips fall? I can't believe that anybody at this moment would be talking about having a war with Iran when all that would do would reverse the current situation, which seems to be going in Israel's favor?
You know, in politics, and especially in geopolitics, you never know what's in your favor, and you should not, neither as an individual nor as a state, try to impose your utopias over political actualities. If this is the Middle East, let it work. Let's see what develops. We all saw what happened when the United States of America, of George W. Bush, tried to impose top-down hollow democracy over Iraq and see what happened to the region. It is not the most stable one, to say the least. And I can go with many, many examples like that. And my policy is Israel has to do its best, A, to defend itself from whatever is coming ahead of us from the other side of the border, be ready both for war and both for peace, because maybe something else will take over the regions and the regimes in the area. And the second is, it shouldn't be Israel who jumps to the head of the line and do the dirty work for the other local regimes who really do not like nuclear Iran. Saudi Arabia is not happy about it. Egypt is not happy about it. Syria may be happy about it, but it's not our concern. Let them deal with Iran and let us not do the dirty job for them. It is not our role again to reorganize the world. These days are over.
So, Avram Berg, again, the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes, a former speaker of the Israeli Knesset, and he also has an article in Sunday's New York Times, Israel's Fading Democracy. You mentioned earlier the role of Netanyahu in the American presidential race. It's pretty clear that he has a long and close friendship with Romney. It's pretty clear that he wants Romney to be the next president of the United States. And by that, the role of Sheldon Adelson also raises some serious questions about the extent to which Netanyahu is already involved in some strategic advice. As you know, Avram, Sheldon Adelson backed the candidacy of Newt Gingrich, and that had the effect of splitting the anti-Romney vote and thus allowing Romney to get the nomination. And now Adelson has said he'll spend up to $100 million to elect Romney. And he, of course, hosted Romney in Jerusalem at the King David Hotel for breakfast just a week ago. And it would seem to me, given his fealty towards Netanyahu with a Vanity Press newspaper to support him, etc., I think there's some serious evidence now that Netanyahu and his wealthy conservative American friends will do anything they can to get Romney elected.
No comment will be enough of an affirmation for your question, or should we go into details? Let's separate into two parts, okay? The first is the Israeli prime minister, which is my concern, and the second is Sheldon Adelson, which is, in a way, as embarrassing as it is, it's an American affair. I hope that the Americans will learn one day to put a limit to how much money can buy politics, and unfortunately, Sheldon Adelson's money looks like, I mean, I don't know the details, I just read reports that they are being reported publicly, looks like that he buys his political priorities, and this is, for me, a very undemocratic way to impact and to influence political outcomes of elections and democratic processes. And I hope that the Americans will find a way to limit the involvement of people of wealth to bring down presidencies or to bring down coalitions to their knees. It's wrong, and it's wrongdoing. And I don't think it's good whether the billionaire is a Democrat or Republican. Money is not a voter. The second is about the Israeli prime minister. I'm a one who really appreciates friendships. I mean, if he's a friend of Romney, that's okay. Let him give him breakfast and let him sleep at night, and he goes on hitchhiking with his family or whatever it is. But the state is not the private playground of a prime minister. A state like a state of Israel is having many interests. And the major one is that Israel will remain above the partisan politics of America. If Israel will be one side of the house only interest, the Republican one, eventually it has a counterproductive effect on the strategic needs of the state of Israel. And therefore, I believe that here, as much as the Prime Minister of Israel admires, loves, shares the same values with Mitt Romney, he should not express it in public the way he did it here in Jerusalem. In private, I will say, I think that President Obama is a president that potentially has the power to continue the peace legacy of President Carter, that as much as so many Jews around the world, and especially around the right-wing coalitions in Israel, do not like him, he is the one who gave Israel the peace with Egypt that lasted strategically so many years and helped us to secure our southern border. And like President Clinton, who did his utmost to bring more conciliation and more understanding between Israelis and Palestinians. The role of an American president is not to be a permissive parent who lets the whimsy kid Israel to do whatever it's like because it asks for it. The role of an American president is a very parental one, to say no every now and then or show the right direction whenever possible. The right direction is peace. The wrong direction is war. It sounds like Romney goes the wrong direction.
Well, rather than give speeches instead of questions, why don't you just outline some of what you, in your article, Avram Berg, in terms of what concerns you about the direction that Israel is taking? We've, of course, had these shocking reports of young Israelis burning themselves in protest, the Occupy movement camping out. There's a sense that the disparity in wealth in Israel is as obscene as it is here in the United States. Give us your summary of what you feel is the wrong direction in terms of where the nation is heading.
First, about an historic change. Israel was established in 40 as a kind of almost a utopian Garden of Eden, which was a combination of social solidarity and secular progressive direction. Israel was a social democrat secular state at the best of the European democratic legacies. With the years, Israel has become an aggressive capitalist and religious fundamentalist society. Israel of 2012 is not Israel of 1948. This is an historic change, existential change, that took over and actually characterizes our current contemporary affairs. Within the current Israel, there is today kind of an unholy coalition of three fundamentalist establishments: the Orthodox rabbinate, the settlers establishment, and the capitalist dogma. Take the three of them: the nationalistic settlers, the Orthodox and ultra-Orthodox rabbinical existence, and the capitalist maliciousness, and you understand the level and the depth of the social protest in Israel against them all, about the social injustice, about the wrong set of priorities of the state investing beyond our borders on behalf of a small group rather than on behalf of the majority, the needs of the majority, and the permanent ongoing surrender to the ultra-Orthodox establishment in Israel. And this is the nature and the gist of the social justice call coming out of every street and every corner of public life in Israel.
So do you think that there can be a political turnaround? I mean, Bill Clinton recently got into a lot of trouble because he said that Israel's drift to the right has a lot to do with the influx of Russian emigres. Is there a possible of a left-wing revival in Israel?
Here is the situation, and the bottom line answer will be the jury is still out. The political representation of the center-left in Israel does not reflect the positions of the people. The society is still equally split over the Palestinian question, economic questions, church and state questions, equally split two main blocks. Unfortunately, the left parties and the central left representative system simply crashed, and there is a ongoing vote of non-confidence saying you do not really stand for your own values and therefore we do not vote for you. If the parties of the center and left will know how to restore their integrity and to stand for the real values of half of the society, so we are still neck to neck. In a neck to neck situation, everything is possible. And as I said, the jury is out.
So just in closing then, Avram Berg, what is your sense of, I don't know whether you share my alarm at the possibility of Mitt Romney being president, because he has not, for example, he's been running for president for 10 years and he's not bothered to learn about foreign policy. It's as though he will be a kind of corporate CEO who will outsource his foreign policy to the neoconservatives who brought us the Iraq War. That's the entire coterie of his foreign policy advisors. So I'm quite concerned that we'll have an even more aggressive Middle East foreign policy under President Romney than we had under President George W. Bush.
I could not agree with you more, though I have a feeling that we have to pay a little attention to it. You know, politicians eventually are supposed to be human beings. I mean, we do not always deliver, but we are supposed to be so. George W. Bush, with all of his shortcomings, was a very warm human being. The feeling that so many Israelis got when Mitt Romney came here, that he is many things, warmth, is not one of his strong elements. And an American president which looks at the situation in the Middle East with no affection, with no human warmth, with no empathy, might be a very dangerous one, not just for Israel, but for the entire region, because the region needs a parent, and a parent who does not have a good, warm, open heart to all sides in the region might be a very, very, very dangerous one. The Middle East calls for balance. The Middle East needs an even hand or even-handed a president, does not need a one-sided right-wing fundamentalist.
Well, Avram Berg, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Avram Berg, who's the son of Holocaust survivors and has been active in politics as a leader in the Israeli Labour Party and the One Israel Party. He was Speaker of the Knesset from 1999 to 2003 and is the author of The Holocaust is Over, We Must Rise from Its Ashes. He's now the chairman of Malad, the Center for Renewal of Democracy, and has an op-ed in Sunday's New York Times, Israel's Fading Democracy. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with Michael Tomasky, the author of the cover article in the current issue of Newsweek, Mitt Romney's Wimp Factor.
How low were you willing to go before you reach all your selfish goals? Impatient after impatient.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Michael Tomasky, a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and editor of Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. He has the cover story in the current issue of Newsweek, Mitt Romney's Wimp Factor, A Mouse in the White House. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Tomasky.
Nice to be with you.
And just to read the subtitle or the slug for your cover article in the current issue of Newsweek, Mitt Romney's Wimp Factor, dodging reporters, fearing his base, hiding his taxes. Is Mitt Romney just too insecure to be president? So that's a shot across his bow.
You know, look at the way, look at the evidence that we put forward in the piece. I think the things that you just mentioned from that subtitle lead us towards certain conclusions about a guy who doesn't want to. Two things in particular stand out to me. Number one, he kind of doesn't want to have to really want to run a race. He just sort of feels like he should win because the economy is bad and his career is in business. So he's not releasing his tax returns. He's not taking specific positions, which even Republicans criticize him for, Bill Kristol and George Will and other people. And he's just trying all the things that one has to do normally to become president. He's trying to skate in without having to do them. Number two, and I think even more importantly, is his failure, complete unwillingness to take even one position, even one, that stands up in any way to the right-wing base of the Republican Party. And he has flipped, Ian, on six or seven major issues from his earlier races: abortion, immigration, where he once supported a path to amnesty and now does not, gun control, he once supported an assault weapons ban, a couple of other social issues, and of course health care, where he's now denounces his own plan. I can guarantee you nobody ever has run for president in the modern history of this country flip-flopping like that to accommodate and pander to a base. Nobody.
Well, it seems if you combine his attitude, which is, I think, apparent, and his wife's, who said, "We've given you people all you need to know about our taxes," there does appear to be a kind of sense of entitlement about them. And I think as a president, he will sort of be the CEO of America, where he'll essentially, instead of having a press secretary, they'll just release press reports. There'll be no access. He's been running for about 10 years, and he's never bothered to even inform himself on foreign policy, and right. he'll just outsource that to the neocons. I mean, that seems to be what's shaping up here. We're going to have the first kind of corporate CEO of USA Incorporated.
The thing that really bothers me is that he's not really taking serious positions in this campaign in any way, shape, or form. Now, John McCain, he did a bit of the same kind of game, but by gosh, if you go back and look at John McCain's 2008 health care proposal, it was pretty specific and pretty detailed. There was a lot of it that I didn't necessarily agree with, but there was a lot that I did agree with, and he had an individual mandate in there. But it was very detailed, down to, very particular things about medical loss ratios and things like that. Romney's doing none of that. He's not taking actual positions that have to do with governing the country. He's just issuing bromides that he knows will please the right-wing vote.
So is that to say then that he is really kind of a corporate CEO or a pitch man for Bain Capital, in the sense that he'll just say anything to close the deal? Is that what it comes down to?
Yeah, I think that's pretty well said. Yeah, he'll say anything to close the deal. And we're supposed to take it on faith somehow that once he gets in there, he's going to be serious. Well, how do I know that? How do I know that he's going to be serious about governing once he's in there? How do I know that he's not going to do Grover Norquist's bidding and the evangelical right's bidding on social issues? Every indication he's given us is that that's all he's going to do, is do those people's bidding. So, I mean, that's just not a strong person. That's a weak person.
Again, I'm speaking with Michael Tomasky, who's a special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and editor of Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. He has the cover story in the current issue of Newsweek, Mitt Romney's Wimp Factor, A Mouse in the White House. So doesn't this, though, the Wimp Factor, broaden out largely beyond Romney and into the whole Republican Party, in as much as the Republican establishment, who've just been, bruised repeatedly mugged, I guess, if you like, with Murdoch beating a very, very highly regarded Republican, Dick Lugar. Romney just campaigned for Murdoch over the weekend. You've got this blowout in Texas with Ted Cruz, the Hispanic Cuban American, who can't speak Spanish, by the way. And it seems to me that the reporting says, the Republican establishment just took another hit from the Tea Party. The Republican establishment is basically supine and rolled over for them, haven't they?
Yeah, no one will stand up and say anything. They're a terrified, spineless bunch. You're absolutely right. It was very emblematic in 2009. When in March of 2009, Chuck Grassley, the senator from Iowa,
certainly conservative, like Dick Lugar, no question, quite a conservative guy, but not a radical. In March of 2009, Chuck Grassley was saying the individual mandate is something that there's been a lot of agreement about on both sides of the aisle. Then he went home. Then the summer happened. He went home for a few town hall meetings, came back to Washington tweeting about killing grandma. And that was just fear. That was fear of what he saw back at home in those town hall meetings and fear of the idea that he might face a primary from the right. And that's how they're all operating. Lugar did it too, Orrin Hatch. You know, Barney Frank had a great line in an interview he did with New York Magazine a few months ago. And the interviewer asked him something like, have they all basically become Michelle Bachmann? And he said, that's overstating it. About half of them are Michelle Bachmann, and the other half are afraid of being primaried by Michelle Bachmann. That's the reality.
Well, it seems, though, that you've got to go beyond, I think, the Tea Party phenomenon to really ask the question, who's backing the Tea Party and what do they get out of it? Because one of the great paradoxes of the Tea Party, they were born out of outrage over the TARP payment to rescue Wall Street. And yet their current policies are totally pro-Wall Street. It seems that they are the most reliable corporate vote out there. They basically do the bidding of the big, powerful interests that seem to be backing them, whether it's money being laundered through Grover Norquist or Dick Armey. That's what I'd like to get an understanding of what the quid pro quo here is, because they are bomb throwers. They are obstructionists. But what do the people that are funding them get out of it?
They get troops on the ground who support a very pro-corporatist position and make it sound to the average news viewer like it's a prairie populist position. So they're pretty lucky. They're coming out of this pretty happy. I mean, if I were David Koch, I'd wake up every morning and say, man, I can't believe my good fortune. Here I am, you know, my agenda is really, you know, protect my money. Protect the money of people who are rich like me and the free enterprise system, as I define it. And lo and behold, here I've got these people, you know, who make, you know, $60,000 a year out there, you know, with bloodlust in their eyes, defending my position.
Well, just to touch on Ted Cruz, who beat a very conservative candidate in the Lieutenant Governor Dewhurst of Texas, who was a protege of Governor Perry's, and nobody could argue that Perry's anything but an arch-conservative. Although what's interesting about Cruz is that he's a very, very intelligent guy with a fairly impressive resume. Is it possible that he could become a leader of this movement, which is kind of inchoate, you know, largely doing the bidding of the oligarchs? But do you think it has the potential? You could argue that it's intimidated the Republican Party.
Yeah.
Whether it's taken it over or not is something that we should be watching, surely.
Yeah, you know, you can't quite say that it's taken over the Republican Party, but you know, certainly the Republican Party is so far to the right of where it was in 2008. That it almost doesn't matter whether it's taken over. You know, it combined with reflexive, rabid anti-Obamaism, such that anything that Obama's for, they're against, even things that they were once for, as we well know, long list, payroll tax reduction, the individual mandate, the bailout, which many Republicans voted for, the first bailout when Bush was president, so on and so on. So you combine those two things, this Tea Party sentiment and the reflexive anti-Obamaism, and it just makes for a party that is way out there, and you know, it almost doesn't matter whether the label on a particular candidate is Tea Party or not. They're just, you know, they're going to have to hew to a lot of, you know, very hardcore positions to hope to get elected.
Well, without appearing to resort to the sort of cheap hyperbole of the left where everybody's a fascist, it seems, though, that the Tea Party tactic, if you will, or their stance so far in the House has been of pure obstruction. And they do seem to fit the mold of the totalitarians, whether they were communists or Nazis, who enter the political process to bring down the government, not to participate in it. After all, Mitch McConnell said that was his main priority, was to get rid of Obama. So it feels to me that these people really are totalitarians. They don't want to negotiate. They don't want to compromise. They just want to destroy.
They certainly want to destroy much of the domestic federal budget. There's no question about that. They probably don't want to destroy, you know, the defense establishment. I think they're probably fine with it. But there's no question that they just don't think the government should be doing a lot of the things that it does. And they want to destroy that. I don't know, Environmental Protection Agency. You know, people want to get rid of the Environmental Protection Agency until, of course, there's some kind of toxic dump in their district. Then they come. Then they're the first people on the phone to call the EPA and say, "Come help." Mm-hmm. But yeah, they want to. Grover Norquist's old phrase, you know, drown it in the bathtub.
Yeah, so put it in the bathtub so it's you can strangle it or something.
Yeah, something like that.
Make it small enough to, that it'll fit in the bathtub so you can drown it.
So you can drown it, yeah.
So why do you think then, Michael Tomasky, that he's got a chance of winning, which he clearly does have?
Well, it's the simple reason, the economy. And you know, Barack Obama's at 47% approval rating and one of... or 48, and when an incumbent is below 50, he's in dangerous territory. So, you know, Mitt Romney has a good chance. Now, I don't think he has a great chance. I actually think that, particularly if you look at the Electoral College and weigh it out state by state, the Electoral College still pretty strongly favors Obama for a lot of reasons that, you know, we don't have the time to go into now, but just there are more ways to 270 electoral votes for Obama than there are for Romney. But, you know, that's not to say that some dynamic, you know, a new economic shock or setback of some kind in the fall might not change things and make Romney the favorite.
Just in closing, Michael Tomasky, we're going to be talking with the former chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, looking into Mitt Romney's taxes. And it seems to me that a lot of reporters are circling around the possibility, and this is pretty much what I've been told, is that it looks as the reason that Romney's playing hardball on his taxes and drawing a line there is that he may well have taken amnesty in 2009, when a lot of people, 35,000 wealthy Americans came in from the cold and had to be forgiven. They had to pay their back taxes, but they were put back into the system for hiding a lot of their money offshore. And do you have a sense that, I mean, Harry Reid seems to be confident in his source. It's pretty perverse that the tables have turned on him. But do you think this tax thing is going to come to a head?
I think it will. It's just hard to imagine that Romney can go until Election Day not releasing his taxes, but maybe he can. It's pretty clear that he's going to try. This amnesty question, I think that would be pretty much a nuclear bomb. I think that would be really difficult for him to explain as a candidate for president of the United States. Other things, hard to say. A lot of people talk about the IRA. That's worth up to $100 million. How do you get that much money in an IRA, and what exactly are the benefits of it, and what did it save him? All these things, that devices and techniques that aren't available to regular people. I just nobody can make him release them, right? So I guess at some point.
But that tells you that. There's some really good reason why he doesn't want them released.
It does, but still, if none of us knows, it's all speculation on everybody's part, right? And I'm sure they poll it every week or every 3 days probably inside that campaign, and the polling indicates that they're taking a smaller hit by doing this, by stonewalling, than they would be by releasing them and revealing what's in there.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Michael Tomasky.
A pleasure. Enjoyed it.
So did I. Again, I've been speaking with Michael Tomasky, special correspondent for Newsweek and The Daily Beast, and editor of Democracy, a Journal of Ideas. He has the cover story in the current issue of Newsweek, Mitt Romney's Wimp Factor, A Mouse in the White House. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about what Mitt Romney is hiding in terms of his taxes.
You never want to believe your son.
sin that you really are, then you won't be laughing so hard. No, you won't be laughing so hard. Yeah, I'm the tax man. If you drive a car, car,
I'll tax the street.
If you drive to six,
I'll tax your seat.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Edward Kleinbart, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. His recent academic papers include Stateless Income and Tax Expenditure Framework Legislation. Before joining USC Law, he served as the Chief of Staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and prior to that was for over 20 years a partner in one of New York's largest and most prestigious law firms. He has an article at CNN with Peter Kanellis, Why Won't Romney Release More Tax Returns? Welcome to Background Briefing, Edward Kleinbart.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Romney is in the face of criticism from the press and from Harry Reid in the majority leader of the Senate, who's accused Romney of having he says he has a source at Bain Capital who said that Romney didn't pay taxes for 10 years. But in response to that, Romney keeps saying he's paid taxes, lots of taxes. But that's a meaningless statement. I've paid taxes. You've paid taxes. We could all make that statement. He's not saying whether he's paid his income taxes.
That's absolutely correct. And, of course, lots of taxes is a relative concept. In 2010, the Romneys earned over $20 million. If he paid $1 million in tax, that it sounds like a large number to you and to me relative to our incomes, but would actually be an extraordinarily small, low rate of tax with respect to a $20 million income.
So why is, I guess, I don't know why the press aren't asking follow-through questions. I suppose one of the problems is Romney doesn't really offer himself up to the press, really.
Well, yeah, I can't comment on why the press does what it does. I do think that there are a lot of good reasons why we as a country ought to be pressing this issue, and therefore the press should be concerned about it. The way I look at things, that past tax returns of a candidate are a window into the candidate's financial integrity as well as his attitude towards fundamental legal compliance at a time before the spotlight is on him. And that's why past tax returns are very important. And the other reason, of course, is that the returns give detailed information about the sources and amounts of a candidate's income, which enables us all to form our own judgments about whether the candidate has any conflicts of interest in respect of how he'll approach the development of tax policy. After all, the president is not just the commander-in-chief, he's also the taxer-in-chief.
Well, I think that's a very a point well taken, Ed Kleinbart, because essentially, given that Romney appears to sort of be heading towards, if he becomes president, a kind of regime where he'd be the CEO of USA Incorporated, he seems to approach his presidency, at least as much as he's outlined it, in terms of being a manager, not a leader so much as a manager, and that he would manage America as a way the CEO manages a corporation. And, you know, if he's managing USA Incorporated, he's got to be thinking about corporate revenues, which is taxes.
Well, exactly right. From our, our expense is the government's income. That's absolutely right. And you know, you're making a very interesting point. The most prestigious nonpartisan tax think tank in the United States is the Tax Policy Center in Washington. And it is a nonpartisan organization. Bill Gale, Adam Looney, and others at Tax Policy Center just did a major study on the one aspect of Governor Romney's taxes that we can talk about, which is with some detail, which is his proposals for how he would rewrite the tax laws. And what those authors demonstrated is that no matter how you slice it, if Romney is going to make good on his promise to reduce tax rates on the top incomes and keep revenues where they are in terms of the percentage of GDP, the end result is that those earning less than $200,000 a year, give or take, which is to say the bottom 97% of America, will pay more tax. And Romney and others with very high incomes will pay dramatically less tax. So we could talk about why the press has not been more attentive to Romney's personal tax situation, because I think it is a window into his fiscal soul. But we ought also to remember that his actual legislative proposal for reforming the tax system is one that would give him an enormous personal benefit and would mean that 97% of America would pay a higher tax.
Again, I'm speaking with Edward Kleinbart, a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law. His work focuses on taxation of capital income, international tax issues, and the political economy of taxation, including the intersection of tax policy and contemporary politics. His recent academic papers include stateless income and tax expenditure framework legislation. Before joining USC Law, he served as the chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation, and prior to that was for over 20 years a partner in one of New York's largest and most prestigious law firms. He has an article at CNN with Peter Canellis, Why Won't Romney Release More Tax Returns? Now, in your article, you say that Mitt Romney only, well, we all know that he only released one complete tax return of 2010, but that Romney's 2010 tax return reveals red flags about tax compliance issues. Now, my understanding is that a real red flag, and in fact, you mentioned this in the article at CNN, you say that, ask rhetorically, did the Romneys timely file the required disclosure forms to the Treasury Department's, the so-called FBAR reports? The IRS announced in 2009 a partial tax amnesty for unreported foreign bank accounts in light of the Justice Department's criminal investigations involving several Swiss banks. To date, some 34,500 Americans have taken advantage of such amnesty programs. Did the Romneys avail themselves of this amnesty program? Now, that's, I think, an incredibly important question. And
to be clear, Ian, it is a question. In other words, I have no inside information as to the answer, but it is a fair question. And the reason that it's a fair question is that the Swiss bank account disappeared in 2010. So this was the last year that it appeared on a return. Why did it disappear in 2010? What's the purpose of a Swiss bank account? That's the fundamentally strange thing here. It was a very small part of his net wealth. The trustee of his so-called blind trust has said that he wanted to diversify, which meant, in fact, that what he was saying is that he wanted, on behalf of Mr. Romney, to bet against the United States dollar and on the theory that the Swiss franc would perform better. But there are actually, you know, perfectly easy ways to bet on the Swiss franc without going to the trouble of opening up an actual account in Switzerland. So on its face, it's a strange thing for somebody of his wealth to do, and it therefore invites the question. I was shocked, let me be very clear, when the UBS scandal broke rampant tax cheating by Americans, notwithstanding the fact that I'd worked for Congress, that I'd worked, on Wall Street for many decades. I was shocked by the magnitude of the tax cheating. And the compliance with the FBAR reporting, which is not an income tax form, it's designed to prevent money laundering and terrorist activities. It's a very important form for those reasons. Compliance with the FBAR turns out to have been extremely spotty, to put it charitably, across the country. So it's a question to be asked. It's one that in the ordinary course, none of us would even think to ask because we would have a dozen years of tax returns and the question would answer itself. But it comes up because we don't have those dozen years of tax returns that we ordinarily would.
Well, Ed Kleinbart, I recently spoke with James Henry, who was the lead researcher of the Tax Justice Network's recent report on how much offshore income is being hidden around the world. And their figure was $21 trillion, but they also said it could be as high as $32 trillion. Yeah. And that in itself is extraordinary. That's twice the national debt of idle income. Now, they weren't all wealthy Americans, obviously. There are all kinds of seedy dictators.
Yeah, it's a global phenomenon. That's absolutely right. And what's interesting in respect to the United States, is that the U.S. Treasury Department has made gigantic steps forward since the UBS scandal. Congress created a new legislative framework in which it now demands more of foreign banks by way of a disclosure of the information, the income, and bank accounts of balances of U.S. Investors. This is the so-called FATCA program. Americans and some congressmen, have continued to resist and be dragged kicking and screaming into a world in which they simply are going to have reporting on their foreign bank accounts the same as the 1099s that you get today for interest or dividends. But what's even more remarkable is that the United States actually behaves today as something of a haven for tax cheats from other countries. Because the United States, up to this point, doesn't collect information on the income earned by foreigners in U.S. banks. And as a result, banks, particularly in Florida and Texas, have gigantic amounts of deposits that are coming from tax cheats in Latin American countries. And we have congressmen and senators who have stoutly resisted the United States collecting the information on those foreigners and conveying it to the foreign countries' tax administrations because apparently operating as a tax haven for others is good business. At the same time that we all recognize that we have to insist on getting information from those same foreign countries about U.S. persons. So it's a very frustrating area.
Again, I'm speaking with Edward Kleinbart, who served as Chief of Staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. And just to go back to James Henry, though, he said that he thinks the smoking gun that Mitt Romney is hiding and refuses to release his taxes is the 2009 return. And he believes that he did take the amnesty and it's retroactive. I think and of course that's the 10 years that Harry Reid's talking about. So if he did take the amnesty program in 2009, that year's income tax that he refuses to release would reveal all of the back taxes. They have to be adjusted, don't they? All those returns.
Yes. The amnesty is a partial amnesty as to penalties. It's not a forgiveness of the actual tax due. That would be an extraordinary development. It's one, as I say, that frankly would surprise me if it were true. But on its face, the facts are quite puzzling. The relatively small, relative to his wealth, the $3 million Swiss bank account just doesn't make a lot of sense as a financial move. And somebody of his wealth and sophistication can bet on the Swiss franc in a much more straightforward way. So
betting against the dollar, though, right?
There, and the mystery, it's really incumbent on the candidate to clear this stuff up. You know, one of the reasons that this gets frustrating, some people say he has no legal obligation to release these returns, and that's absolutely true. But we do have social norms. You know, when I go to a restaurant or a store, I say please and thank you, not because there's a law that tells me I have to, but because that's the way mature adults behave in contemporary society. And we have a clear norm here as well, and that is that candidates disclose their taxes for the reasons I said before, that they go to questions of fiscal integrity, they go to questions of attitude and conflicts of interest. We have good reasons for this norm, and it's a norm that was established by Mitt Romney's own father, George Romney. So we have an unbroken bipartisan social norm here, and now for no reason at all that has been developed, that has been offered, Mitt Romney has declared himself to be outside of this social norm. And I think a lot of people react to that by seeing that as a inexplicable kind of arrogance at work. That what else but arrogance could explain the idea that you don't say please and thank you in a store because you're so much better than the waiter or the clerk who's serving you? What other than arrogance could explain this refusal? Now, what one answer might be that there are terrible things in the return, but even if there are not, the simple arrogance of refusing to participate in a perfectly rational norm that applies to all other candidates for office,
including vice presidents, by the way.
Including vice presidents.
He will require whoever he picks as his vice president to furnish his tax returns.
Yes, just as it is, said in the press that he did. He furnished to Senator McCain.
23 years.
Exactly. So, either there's something troubling in the return substantively, or the refusal itself hits a sour note with a great many Americans because it resonates as a kind of arrogance, as a kind of a statement that the ordinary rules do not apply to me, Mitt Romney. And either way, it's a very odd position that he's put himself in.
Well, just on the surface, though, having a Swiss bank account indicates that he's betting against the dollar, which is not entirely patriotic. And the other thing that that comes out of the 2010 return the only one that he's furnished so far, is that he had about $102 million in an IRA, and most accountants I talk to say that's next to impossible.
Well, I before this call, I checked my IRA balance, and I'm sad to report it's significantly lower than $102 million. There are many explanations for that. No doubt Mitt Romney is a better investor than I am. But the IRA is, I think, the most... on its face, the most visible red flag that something unusual is going on. And what I believe is going on, and this is, just by virtue of having worked with financial people, for many years, as well as thinking about the size of the return and the nature of his income from the private equity industry, is that he, in effect, was putting in more than the maximum permitted by law, which was $30,000 at the time, $30,000 a year by in value of securities. And he was doing that because he was dealing with private insider stock where there were no external commercial checks or balances on the values that were being placed. So you put a value of 10 cents on the dollar on a financial instrument, well, you can buy $300,000 a year instead of $30,000. Those are the kind of questions that, frankly, are just on the face of the return, given the magnitude of the IRA, are the kind of questions that are substantively perfectly fair to raise. It's a fair inference that that's that kind of systematic undervaluation was going on. And you know, that raises another related point, which is that Governor Romney has suggested that he didn't do anything differently than what you and I do, except what he does has more zeros at the end of it. But that's not really true. You and I don't have access to private deals where we can assign different relative values to the interests of companies that our group is purchasing and controlling. Our IRAs go into the market, and like any other schnook, you know, we buy 100 shares of this or 100 shares of that, either directly or through a mutual fund. We don't have access to these kinds of private deals to begin with. We don't, at least I'm speaking for myself, I assume also for you, we don't take our hobbies and treat them as businesses and purport to deduct business losses. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we did, I would be showing, you know, a very low tax rate once you deducted all of my bicycling equipment. But we recognize, you know, that in my case, my cycling is a hobby.
Right.
The Romneys
as opposed to
that their horse is a business.
Right. $77,000 deduction for this prancing horse. More than most Americans make, certainly more than most Americans make in a year. I'm afraid we have to wrap up here, and I know you're doing some more work on Romney's role as chairman of the Marriott Corporation's Audit Committee, where they made up fictional losses, just created them out of thin air, of $70 million, and the IRS busted them on that. And also, as we mentioned, the press should do at least follow up on Romney's absurd assertion when he says he's paid taxes and lots of taxes. That's a meaningless statement, totally, absolutely meaningless. I thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Edward Kleinbart, who's a professor of law at the University of Southern California's Gould School of Law, and he was formerly the chief of staff of the United States Congress's Joint Committee on Taxation. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. And you can't see.